And now on the space show, we're heading off to Mars. You can see Mars in the western sky at the moment. It's quite near the planet Venus. Now, if you look west right now, or any time until about 9 o'clock, you can see the very bright light in the western sky. That is the planet Venus, and quite close to it is a reddish-looking, much fainter object, and that is the planet Mars. Well, data from NASA's Phoenix Mars lander suggests that liquid water has interacted with the Martian surface throughout the planet's history and into modern times. The research also provides new evidence that volcanic activity has persisted on the red planet into geologically recent times. Now, by recent, we mean several million years ago. Now, although the lander, which arrived in Mars in 2008, May the 25th, is no longer operating, NASA scientists continue to analyze data gathered from that mission. These recent findings are based on data about the planet's carbon dioxide, which makes up about 95% of the Martian atmosphere. Paul Nyers is a space scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. He says, and we quote, "Atmospheric carbon dioxide is like a chemical spy," he added. "It infiltrates every part of the surface of Mars and can indicate the presence of water and its history." Well, Phoenix precisely measured isotopes of carbon and oxygen in the carbon dioxide of the Martian atmosphere. Isotopes are variants of the same element with different relative atomic masses. Niles is lead author of a paper about the findings published last week in the online edition of the journal Science. The paper explains the ratios of stable isotopes and their implications for the history of Martian water and volcanoes. Niles said, and we quote again, "Isotopes can be used as a chemical signature that can tell us where something came from and what kinds of events it has experienced. This chemical signature suggests that liquid water primarily existed at temperatures near freezing and that hydrothermal systems similar to New Zealand's hot springs have been rare throughout the planet's past. Measurements concerning carbon dioxide show Mars is a much more active planet than previously thought. The results imply Mars has replenished its atmospheric carbon dioxide relatively recently and that carbon dioxide has reacted with water present on the surface." Well, the measurements were performed by the instrument on Phoenix called the Evolved Gas Analyzer. The instrument was capable of doing more accurate analysis of the carbon dioxide than similar instruments that were carried on NASA's Viking landers in the 1970s. The Viking program provided the only previous Mars isotope data sent back to Earth. The low gravity and lack of a magnetic field on Mars mean that as carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere, it will be lost to space. This process favors loss of a lighter isotope named carbon-12 compared to carbon-13. Now, if Martian carbon dioxide had experienced only this process of atmospheric loss without some additional processes replenishing the carbon-12, the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 would be much higher than what Phoenix was able to measure. This suggests the Martian atmosphere recently has been replenished with carbon dioxide emitted from volcanoes, and volcanism has been an active process in Mars's recent past. However, a volcanic signature is not present in the proportions of two other isotopes, that is, oxygen-18 and oxygen-16, and those isotopes are found in Martian carbon dioxide. The findings suggest the carbon dioxide has reacted with liquid water, which enriched the oxygen in carbon dioxide with the heavier oxygen-18. Niles and his team theorize that this oxygen isotopic signature indicates liquid water has been present on the Martian surface recently enough and abundantly enough to affect the composition of the current atmosphere. The findings do not reveal scientific locations or dates of liquid water and volcanic events, but recent occurrences of those conditions provide the best explanations for the isotope proportions. Well, they're building a new rover to go to Mars. It's due to be launched there next year. And at the moment, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, they are putting things together and testing it out and seeing how it all works, and doing some of this work at the Goddard Space Flight Center as well. And we have here two reports about progress being made towards getting the rover ready.
My name is Peter Ilsley. I'm the rover integration lead for MSL during the assembly test and launch operations phase, or ATLO. The tests we're doing now are actually helping us learn how to drive the arm from both the operator side as well as the flight software side, helping us develop that rover hand-eye coordination. Let's say we wanted to go drill a rock. The way we do that as humans is actually we use our depth perception and we look at that rock in space and we say, oh, we think it's about so far away. Well, that judgment has come through our human experience as we've learned exactly how far away our arms are from things. The rover needs to do the same thing. But right now, it's not very good at predicting that. It certainly is one of the most complicated things we do with the rover, simply because of the number of degrees of freedom of the arm, the number of motions the arm can make. The arm can actually collide with the rover. The arm can actually hurt the rover if we're not careful. Just like you can poke yourself in the eye, we can do the same with the rover. So we have to teach it not to do that by defining a space it keeps out of. The next test sequence, we're going to actually lift the rover onto a tilt table and tilt it up to 20 degrees, and that's where we'll actually simulate being on a crater wall or a large slope or a large obstacle so that we will understand how that change in gravity vector will actually affect that same set of arm motion. I actually think this is one of the most rewarding times in the build process. This is really where you get to see all of those neat firsts of the rover, the first drive, the first motions of the arm with the flight system software and with the rest of the flight system hooked up to it. And seeing that successfully work is incredibly rewarding. I'm Peter Ilsley, and this has been your Building Curiosity Update.
And we have another report from those people building the Curiosity Mars Science Laboratory.
My name is Sean Haggart. I'm a mobility engineer on the Mars Science Laboratory. So as you can see down there, we just recently completed testing the wheels and suspension system on the flight rover. Now, the mobility system might look familiar. It's a classic rocker bogey suspension system that we've used for the last two generations of Mars rovers. And it does a lot of things that actually the mobility system hasn't done in the past. So for this mission, the mobility system not only drives the rover around, it's also the landing gear. The wheels are actually the first thing that make contact with the surface of Mars. Now, just about everything you see on the mobility system looks black, but that doesn't mean it's all the same material. The tubes, the suspension arms coming down to the wheels, those are all titanium. The tires themselves, those are aluminum. The shell on those tires is actually a piece of machined aluminum that's about 30 thousandths of an inch thick. That's about the thickness of 7 pieces of paper. And when they're that thin, it makes them actually soft. And so they behave in much the way that a rubber tire would behave and give you that springy load for landing, for driving over rocks. This test was sort of an obstacle course for the rover, because we have to drive over obstacles of certain heights. Those correspond to rocks of certain heights that we expect to see on the surface of Mars. And so those ramps were mimicking those rocks to make sure that we can actually drive over them and get to the science. Now, you notice that it's six-wheel drive and all four corner wheels steer. Now, those wheels can steer plus or minus 90 degrees. And what that allows you to do is actually position the wheels, kind of toe in, and turn the rover in place. And that makes it a very maneuverable platform to position itself for science. Now, what you saw in that test was actually top speed of the rover, about 4 centimeters per second. Or to put it another way, it takes about 40 minutes to go the length of a football field. We want to go slow, because when you're 50 million miles away from the nearest service station, it's okay to go a little slow and be a little careful. My name is Sean Haggart. This has been your Building Curiosity Update.
And you're listening to The Space Show on 88.3 Sullen FM, where we are looking at the ways of exploring Mars. Now, we heard earlier about the isotope puzzle on Mars, and there is another puzzle, and that is, where does the methane that we are now detecting on Mars come from? And it may well be linked to that other puzzle, the isotope puzzle, because volcanism could be the culprit, or maybe, just maybe, there are living things on Mars. Anyway, here's Michael Muma with the details.
My name is Michael Muma. I work at the Goddard Space Flight Center for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in Greenbelt, Maryland. Our team has discovered methane on Mars. The surprising thing about methane on Mars is that first that we detect it, meaning it's recently generated, but in addition, we find that it's being released from several discrete vents or sites on the planet's surface in either midsummer in the northern hemisphere or early spring in the southern hemisphere on Mars. And yet at a later season, we see essentially no methane. The big question is, what is the origin of this methane now being released? The two principal areas are, first, by analogy with the Earth, it could be released and produced initially primarily by biology. This would be microbial activity acting on certain chemicals below the surface and then producing methane as a byproduct. But of course, we can't state with certitude that it is biologically produced. And so we also consider geochemical mechanisms in which carbon dioxide is actually combining with water and producing methane under very high temperatures and pressures. And that methane can then be released in the atmosphere separately. One of the most important consequences of our discoveries is that we've identified certain signposts on Mars that basically are like little flags that say, come here, here I am. NASA has several missions along these lines. One is called the Mars Science Laboratory. One of the key objectives is to understand whether life ever arose on Mars by sampling the material on the surface and then evaluating that in terms of its origins. You can appreciate that if you go to this right location, you may in fact be able to identify whether biology was at work or geochemistry.
And our reporter there was Michael Moomer. He's a scientist at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And that report came courtesy of the Goddard Space Flight Center. Now, of course, well, many people would like to go to Mars, and there are active plans to try and do that. But there's a lot of things we've got to find out first. And I was at the Kennedy Space Center in April, in fact, on April the 3rd, and I attended a press conference given by a number of people involved in the science on the International Space Station. And we're going to hear from two of them in a few moments about the research being done into the medical problems that might happen on a trip to Mars and what would be needed. And the two main problems is bone, keeping the bones dense, and also radiation, because the radiation from the sun is and cosmic radiation is pretty intense. And the two speakers we're going to hear from is first Nobuyoshi Fujimoto. He's a senior engineer at the Space Systems and Utilization section of the Japan Aerospace Agency. And question is put to him by a reporter.
John Tierney with the New York Times. For both of the researchers, do you have any general thoughts about what we've learned, either that's encouraging or discouraging about the prospects for going to Mars, about the effects of muscle atrophy on the crew, the effects of radiation, and dealing with emergencies along the way? It's a general question, but
it's very, at this moment, difficult question because the space radiation on the moon or towards the moon is much, much higher than the ISS orbit. So it must be affected crew health. So we need to investigate and protect crew members from the space radiation if we go to the moon or Mars. So that is an engineering challenge. We, in order to prepare for that, we would like to continue the experiment on board the space station to learn about the effect of the space radiation. About the muscle atrophy, I think it's rather positive because we have some countermeasure. One is, of course, the crew exercise. And also, on board the space station, we are now investigating to using some kind of medicine to keep bone or muscle to protect from the atrophy. So that may be overcome in the near future. However, radiation is maybe a much difficult challenge for the future spaceflight.
The other person to answer this question was... Scott Jukowski, who's the International Space Station investigator, and is chairman of the Department of Surgery at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit.
I think that it's encouraging because sometimes when you're faced with a constraint, you have to be particularly innovative. So if we had no constraints, we could fly a vessel that's got a wall of foot thick of lead, and we wouldn't have to worry about all of these things. We could fly a full gym and everything else, and it could be just like Earth, but we don't have that luxury. So we may not actually have an engineering solution to some of those challenges, but we may have a pharmacologic. So you may take a much bigger radiation hit than we would be comfortable in this room, but we may have some wonderful drug protection against that hit. We've already gotten through many of the constraints relative to the bone loss and relative to muscle and things like that. There are more in that, but I think it's very positive, and I'm assuming Clarence has some thoughts on some of the other things that we've done on some of the countermeasures.
Yes, I'd just like to add a couple of points. I think from a global perspective, when you look at the crew members, you find that human beings are much more adaptable than you necessarily expected them to be. But that almost all the control systems are feedback loops, so they respond to the environment that they're in. And, you know, a lot of what we're trying to learn during station is how to balance the fact that you have an adaptive organism that is changing, and how do you keep it within the bounds of where you want. And we have a variety of countermeasures activities that we're doing now, but that, I think, in a large sense, is the overall concept for the human research program. How do you keep people in the bounds of how you keep them healthy and how you keep them able to perform in the way you want them to? Knowing that they're an adaptive system, you've put them in another environment. If you don't do anything, they'll adapt to that environment, which may or may not be the best thing for the organism.
And the comment there from the final comment from Clarence Sams, the chief scientist at the International Space Station's Medical Projects section. And I recorded that at the Kennedy Space Center on April the 3rd. Now, we got more about Mars and so on coming up in the show, but first up, let's hear the station announcement.
Hi, this is Sean Stokey. Join me every Saturday morning from 10 o'clock for Radio Gaga. You'll hear 2 hours of the best mix of rock, pop, dance and disco. Each week our music has a theme. It may be one-hit wonders, unusual band names or the best driving songs. So join me this Saturday from 10 o'clock for Radio Gaga. All we hear is Radio
Gaga, Radio Gugu. If you want to explore Mars or conserve Mars, that's the question. And Guy Murphy is going to answer that on October the 8th. As part of World Space Week, he's going to be speaking at the Victorian Space Science Education Centre. And Guy is the author of Mars, A Survival Guide. He's a local Melbourne person, and the idea behind this talk is that unlike so many places on Earth, Mars is completely devoid of human interference. But as we've just heard in our show, people are coming. Now, searching for life is best done by human explorers, and they bring with them the risk of biological contamination. So if humankind is to establish a permanent foothold on the planet, it will have to commence mining there. So how can we balance preserving the planet's pristine qualities with the competing needs to understand and exploit it? So this is a free event, and but you are advised to book, and the way to go there is to go to the Victorian Space Science Education Centre's website. So just put Google Victorian Space Science Education Centre, or VSSEC. And this talk is at 6:30 p.m. till 7:30 p.m. on October the 8th, which is a Friday. So that's something to look forward to coming up about Mars.